Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Friday, May 13, 2016. The time is 9:34 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska at the Bill Ray Center, room 230. With me at the table this morning, Co-Chairman Kelly.
Hi.
Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
Senator Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
On today's agenda is an update on where the legislature stands on House Bill 247, oil and gas tax credit reform. Is there anything else to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing none, I'd like to invite Commissioner Hoffbeck and Director Ken Alpar to the table. And we do have a PowerPoint this morning, but the commissioner will provide us some opening comments on oil and gas tax credit reform.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Rivino. And I just do have a couple of just introductory remarks, and then I will turn it over to Director Alpert to kind of walk through the status of the bill that's in the House right now. One thing that I think is critical to say, that I think the committee process is working. I think the bill, since first introduction, has changed dramatically, and in many ways for the better. And one of the things that I think we didn't fully recognize was some issues around carry forwards, that at low oil prices, the long-term impacts that some of those can have. And several of the versions of the bill have begun to address that issue. I do want to make it clear. The version of House rules has moved the ball down the field, but it is not at a point yet where the governor can support the House rules version right now. We think that there's some amendments that could still be added. We think the Seaton Wilson compromise package that they're putting together could bring this to the finish line. But we just want to, there was some confusion after testimony that the governor supported the rules bill, and the governor likes the direction it's heading, but that feels that it does still need additional work. There's also some current concern that's been expressed about the spring forecast and whether it's adequately addressing issues associated with expenditure reductions that industry has been implementing. We looked at, up through March, the reported expenses versus what was forecasted in the spring forecast. As far as operating expenditures, it's about dead on. Because we use information provided by industry, and they had given our staff an indication of some of the reductions that they would be making. It's tracking well with that. And on the capital expenditure side, we're still forecasting a little bit less than the actual spend. Now, that's not to say that things aren't going to change dramatically over the next few months, but at least to the point through March, the expenditure side is spot on. The revenue side, we're low. We're forecasting a little less than $40 oil for FY16. Prices are hovering around $45 right now. If they stay there, it will be at a $42 or $43 for FY16. Every dollar above is about $25 million in revenue. So there will be slightly more revenue in 16, unless something catastrophic happens between now and July 1 than we originally forecasted. But that $75 million or so really isn't the critical issue here. The critical issue is if it hovers around $45 a barrel, a lot of the issues associated with carry forward just won't materialize. Around $45 a barrel, industry should be able to operate at a profit, although a very small profit, at least according to our tax structure, a profit under our tax structure, and would not be eligible for carry forwards of losses. So that $45 price point is an important price point, not so much for the additional revenue it generates, but whether the carry forwards actually will materialize at $45 oil. That being said, we still think it's important to fix the issue because we are in an oil price environment that is most people that are forecasting say it's going to be constrained between 35 and 60, 35 and 65. So we're going to be bouncing around in this territory for a while. And we do want to make sure that we have adequately addressed the carry forward issues in this legislation, even if they are not going to be critical this year. And one last point There's a point of confusion, I think, and if we do have carry forwards, how they're dealt with. And a lot of the discussion has surrounded essentially income tax language and how net losses are carried forward for the income tax. And the administration wants to make it very clear that this is not an income tax. Our production tax is a severance tax. We have an income tax. In fact, we have a specific oil and gas income tax on the state's books. Losses can be carried forward on the income tax. They can carry those forward. But when it comes to a production tax, a severance tax, that's a charge based on severing a non-renewable resource from the state. And the administration is very firm on the idea that that should not be allowed to go below zero, that we should not pay somebody to produce our resources for that particular piece, the severance tax. And so the governor said he's willing to accept the fact that the 4% floor is in place, but losses could take it to zero in a given year if companies are losing money, but not that they could carry forward additional losses, which in effect makes it a negative tax. And so that's kind of the premise that the administration is using as it's reviewing the bills. And that's my opening comments.
We have a few questions. Senator
sure.
Dunleavy.
Thank you. Through the chair, does the administration believe that the majority of the tax credit issue is centered on Cook Inlet?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the majority of what will be left with after everything expires, which the last of the North Slopes credits expire this year, is Cook Inlet. The one that isn't, of course, is the net operating loss, which that flows through both sides.
Okay, just want to make sure for the purpose of the public to understand, because I don't think it was your intent, Commissioner, but. Is the issue for the issue is Cook Inlet, and there's some slope issues. The majority of the tax credit issue, as I recall, in terms of a cost of the state, is Cook Inlet, and we know that there's going to be some expiration, as you mentioned. But I just wanted folks to know, because it would seem, if somebody just walked in on the discussion, that we were focused solely on the slope. Where in fact Cook Inlet has a large portion of the tax credit issue, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Maticki.
So as you know, I'm interested in moving beyond the Senate Bill 21 discussion. However, some folks seem to still want to rhetorically focus on the bill as though it has something to do with our primary cashable credit exposures. And Senator Dunleavy asked a good question. HB 280, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, created the Cook Inlet credit exposure, not Senate Bill 21. Can you respond to that?
Through the chair, Senator Maticki. Yes, the majority of the cashable credit issues that we were concerned about with this legislation are legacy issues from the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, from ACEs, from PPT, and there's even some ELF credits in here that we're trying to parse out.
Just, Madam Chair, if I may continue, I just think it's important for the public to understand that. The second thing I'd like to talk about is Senate Bill 21 repealed the 20% CapEx credit. That was a segment of ACEs that was detrimental to the state. And my understanding is the record year for credits, so we're talking about the $700 million range this year, was 2013 under ACEs, where we paid out approximately $918 million in credits because of that part of ACEs. Do you have a comment about that? Again, for folks to understand what the ultimate goal here is, we have a $4.1 billion budget deficit, which is why we're evaluating credits right now. But the ACEs CapEx credit.
Through the chair, Senator Maticki, I would like to defer that to Director Alper, if I could.
Before we move on, Senator Kelly.
When you said $700 million, actually it's $500 million, in the neighborhood of $500 million. Because the governor removed that $200 million last year. We have no idea why he did that. I mean, because it was owed. It was kind of a false reduction, and we knew it would come back in the supplemental or in some other form. But I think it's very important that when we talk about these numbers, about what kind of credit dollars we're talking about, that we use the right numbers. Senator Machicki, I know you were not being disingenuous at all, but I've heard in some of the other discussions that this number of $700 million dollars is just thrown around. It's not $700 million, it's $500 million, because the governor took the $200 million out of last year's budget. Why, we don't know. And now it still remains. It still has to be paid.
Commissioner, Director Alper.
Madam Chairman, for the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. There's a couple of points out there. I'll try to answer them all with a single statement. The credit liability for cash based on the forecast for the next fiscal year, FY17, is $775 million. That's really about $575 plus the $200 that Senator Kelly referenced that sort of carries over from FY16. The FY16 forecast was $700, of which $500 was funded by the legislature and the governor. The legislature put $700 in the budget. The governor ratcheted it back to $500. The peak year for repurchases would be FY17, presuming the full $775 is funded eventually. Senator Machicki referenced FY14 as a peak year. Although the number repurchased in FY14, and I have my table in front of me, my cheat sheet, it was $592 million, a bit lower. That was a peak year for credits against liability of over $900 million. I believe that's the number Senator Machicki referred to. That $900 million was something of a hybrid because you had the crossover between ACEs and Senate Bill 21. So we had the first year of per barrel credits and also the last year of 20% capital credits kind of bumping up against each other within fiscal year 14. And thus, between the cashable and the credits against liability, we actually had a bit over $1.5 billion in total credit liability in fiscal year 2014.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, and I was actually referring to FY13, but the reason I use the 775 number is specifically because the way the press covers this issue, I mean, we're going to have to try to get something on the record that reflects some level of accuracy, that the highest year of credits was because of the ACES CapEx credit and has nothing to do with where we are today, right? So you bring up a good point on the higher end of $500 million, but we did repeal 20% CapEx credit that was overly generous in ACES, and I just think that's important for the public to understand. Don't know if anyone will write a sentence about it, but you can see what I'm trying to capture here, that someone will actually cover it accurately so that Alaskans can understand the issue.
Senator Kelly.
I couldn't agree more. And the boogeyman of credits, many of the dollars that have kind of been stacked up to create the boogeyman, some of those are going away. And I think you make really good points that they were going away anyway. And I doubt that anyone other than maybe the Journal of Commerce or maybe the Associated Press might write something of the truth, but we have no idea what our other friends in the press will write. But I think it's important to hammer away at that because I, for one, if we're creating a boogeyman, let's use the right numbers. The credits are in the neighborhood of $500 million, and when you throw that $700 million out there, you're using a term or a number that isn't quite accurate to describe how the liabilities are stacking up. It reminds me of the mantra that was said over and over and over again: we can't be paying out all these credits when they're more than our production tax. And it was left at that. And the people of Alaska were thinking, oh my gosh, we're actually paying out more in credits than we get. Of course, never was it mentioned that there's royalty and property income tax. And in your discussion, even Commissioner Hoffbeck, and you know the amount of respect I have for you, you talk about severing a non-renewable resource from the state. I get that. And how we don't want to pay less in that. I mean, I understand the thinking in that. But it still ignores the fact that we have been paid for that oil in royalty. And to me, it almost reminds me, well, I won't go with the analogy, that's enough said.
Senator Dunleavy.
Two points or two things. One's a question, one's just a reiteration. I think to the commissioner's credit, on several occasions, starting last year, you're on the record as to saying that the administration does not intend to rewrite SB 21, correct? Or revisit it, rewrite it, whatever.
To the chair, that is correct.
Okay, so we got, I mean, again, we reiterate that on the record that the administration's intent is not to rewrite 21. On the forecast, and I don't know if it would be you or Mr. Albert could address this, you talked about a forecast of 500 plus million plus the 200 that the governor dealt with. When you're doing your forecast moving forward, are you having, are you collecting data to see how potential decreased activity will cause a decrease in draw potentially on credits?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, Ken Alpert speaking. Yes, our credit forecasts are tied to the companies telling us what they're going to do. We update that every several months. The out years are always a little low just because they don't know what they're doing 3 years from now, therefore they can't tell us. We have adjusted those numbers, but to a certain extent, if a project gets delayed, you might see a bump 3 years later and a decrease 1 year later because something is, but the companies tell us they still intend to do it. But our forecast looks fairly accurate. As the commissioner said, the lease expenditures are tracking very closely with our forecast for FY16. Frankly, if the lease expenditures track for 16, that means the credit expectation is going to track pretty closely for FY18 because there's about a 1.5 to 2 year lag between when they're spending the money and when they're coming to us for the reimbursement.
Thanks. Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Other questions from committee members regarding the opening statements? The only question that I have is I've been reviewing the indirect expense report dated January 2015 and specifically looking at the credits and the expiration timing on the credits in our oil and gas division. And I don't know if it's accurate, that's why I want to ask you, but do we really blanket credit the industry with every federal credit that's available that can go against their taxes?
Madam Chairman, Ken Alper, we're really talking about corporate income taxes in this point, and I think what you're referencing is that we're internalizing the federal tax code into our state corporate tax code, and the income that the companies have, which then goes through the apportionment formula and applied to Alaska by a certain percentage, is also going to be internalizing those federal tax credits. And I don't consider myself expert on the corporate income tax side of things, so we could get you a more detailed answer. But in general, I believe that's what that report was referencing.
Mr. Alper, I believe that's right. If you could get back to the committee on the actual implications of how much money or lack of money that Alaska is receiving under that umbrella, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We absolutely will do that.
Thank you. With that, without other questions, we have a PowerPoint. Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the slide deck we have today is relatively short. It's only 9 or 10 slides. This bill is something of a kit of parts. There's a lot of specific provisions that we, the administration, originally introduced. A lot of them have been modified in previous committees. Some new ones have entered the mix. But for the most part, members should be familiar with the range of options and the things we're talking about. So each of these slides looks at one of the issue areas and how we propose to initially address it and then how the current version, the Rules Committee, is addressing it. I also want to draw the committee's attention to the second document I put before you before I start. That looks like this. It's a side-by-side table, and it tries to compare the features of various versions of the bill. In the version before you, I have the current law, the governor's, the version that was amended on the House floor before being sent back to the Rules Committee about a month ago, the committee substitute of the Senate companion bill that came out of the Senate Resources Committee, and that's the actual bill before this committee as we speak, the Rules Committee version. And I also wanted to bring up, just because it has been widely discussed and it might be moved as an amendment today, what the commissioner referenced as the Seaton-Wilson compromise plan. That also is an amendment form and might end up being what this committee sees in a couple of days. So that's on the side-by-side. That bill is not addressed in my PowerPoint, however.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Alpert. Please continue.
Okay. So on the subject of exploration credits, and I apologize that the screen is in the wrong direction for half of your committee, the governor's bill really was a status quo position. We wanted to let the credits that are scheduled to sunset to do so. For the most part, that's happening on July 1st of this year, in a little less than 2 months. There are also the Middle Earth exploration credits had previously been extended till 2022 for drilling work in the interior. Mostly that's, we wanted to continue that sunset. And there are some dormant credits. There are some credits that have not been used for many decades. We look to proactively repeal those as the state's getting out of the direct exploration support business. The Rules Committee substitute, for the most part, kept it the way we left things. There was a specific issue that came up in prior testimony in other committees that the so-called Frontier Basin credit, that's a super credit, an 80-90% credit that's was put in place for some preliminary work in specific high target basins, the Glen Allen area, the Nanana area, et cetera, that because that's sunsetting on July 1st, there might be a well that's half done that might get cut off. There was language that was created mostly to protect the interest of the Otna Native Corporation to ensure that they can finish their well under the credit that might not get done. The current version of the rules bill takes that language and extends it one notch further because they ended up losing their rig, frankly, Madam Chair. They needed another 6 months because the rig they were going to be using this summer got diverted without their being able to control that, so they needed another 6 months. So this Rules Committee substitute gives them that extra 6 months.
Mr. Alpert, before you change that slide, I just want clarification on we're talking about exploration credits. And on bullet two under the governor's bill, it says keeps Middle Earth extension at 1/1/22. Is that what it does, or does the governor's bill extend the credit? I thought it expired, so just for clarity.
Madam Chair, the exploration incentive credit was originally passed in 2003, and it had a sunset probably 4 or 5 years later, and previous legislatures have extended it a couple of times. The most recent extension of the credit statewide was to July 1st, 2016. It was an amendment embedded within Senate Bill 21 that it was extended in the non-Cook Inlet, non-North Slope areas to 2022.
Got it.
So that's current law, and we're simply respecting the current law.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Mr. Alpert, that's the 023-025 credits specifically?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it's the 025A credit, the primary exploration credit. The Frontier Basin credit is also in 025. It's 025A sub 6, I believe. That's the 80% credit that's supposed to go away in July, and that specific one is being extended for 6 months or a year in the Rules Committee bill.
Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Alpert, you called that a super credit. In all other instances, the administration has been making a request for the legislature to extinguish credits or lower credits. So can you speak to the reason why this super credit, if you define what super credit is, and then I understand why the Middle Earth credit is important, but I just want to make sure that those following at home understand why this one is being looked at differently.
Sure, Madam Chair. First, the term super credit first started being used. There was in House Bill 280, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, and a similar Senate bill that passed at the same time, I believe it was actually in the Senate bill 307 or 309, was the so-called Cook Inlet jackup rig credit that you might have heard of. That provided an up to 100% support of the first well drilled with a deep water jackup rig brought to Cook Inlet. It was designed as an extra incentive to try to look for oil and gas in the deep waters of the middle of Cook Inlet, where there hadn't been a rig capable of doing that kind of work for some decades. That was referred to as a super credit because it was order of magnitude larger than what we had previously done. It was, like I said, up to 100%. With the Frontier Basin bill of 2012, they looked to emulate that provision to try to get early work done in these high targeted basins in the Nanana, Glen Allen, Selowik area, six different dots on the map effectively. So those very high percentage super credits were put in place. For the most part, they have frankly not been used. They're a little bit higher hurdles of information to get to them. They're not that much better dollar-wise than simply using the underlying 40% exploration credit stacked with a net operating loss credit. The super credits weren't stackable. You couldn't use them with an operating loss credit. In the case of the jackup rig credit, there was actually a payback requirement. So all of these complexities meant that, for the most part, they weren't being used. They haven't been used. The Aetna Corporation has testified in multiple committees that they are, in fact, using it and trying to drill a well in the Glen Allen area looking to find a gas supply for local utility needs. That's a project they've been working on for several years. They've gone through a lot of hoops and received a lot of permits from DNR. That well should have been drilled by now. It was delayed due to circumstances outside their control, including limitations on the road to Glen Allen and how heavy a load you can carry and how many truckloads it's going to take to move a rig up there, things like that. So when they requested, the earlier committees decided it was a reasonable extension for the 6 months or a year it was going to take to specifically enable them to finish their project under the permits they had gone through all the trouble of getting. The actual cost of that extension is $1 to $2 million, and then hard ended in 6 months to a year.
Thank you. Could you, on the jackup rigs, the Cook Inlet Recovery has found gas, and we have supply for many Alaskans that are along that rail belt corridor. Do we expect then to receive the 50% payback over 10 years, and is that included in the forecast?
Madam Chairman, the jackup rig credit was not actually used for those discoveries for those companies that did bring up jackup rigs. We did, ironically, get a couple of jackup rigs, but those companies didn't claim the jackup rig credit. They found it more advantageous. The underlying system got about 65% state support between the exploration credit or the well use expenditure credit stacked with the NOL. The 100% jackup rig credit that where you have to pay back half of it and had a higher information hurdle and had a more limited expenditure hurdle, the companies made the business decision not to use those credits, so there won't be anything to pay back.
Thank you very much.
Should I continue, Madam Chair?
Please.
Okay. I'm now on slide number 3, which is talking about the Cook Inlet credit. Senator Dunleavy referenced this. The Cook Inlet system is really the old ACES system. It's the spending credit, the capital expenditure credit, augmented by the alternative 40% well lease expenditure credit. Either or, a company can get one or the other on the same expenditure, but either of them could be stacked with the so-called 25% operating loss credit, NOL, if that company is in a loss situation, thus where you get the number up to 65% support. The intent of the governor's bill was to eliminate the drilling credits, the 20 and the 40%, the QCE and the WLE. I apologize for the acronyms, but I think for the most part members are familiar with the major acronyms in the credit system by now, and keeping the operating loss credit. The governor's bill also maintained the 2022 tax cap sunset. These are the PPT era maximum taxes that are in place in Cook Inlet that are scheduled to go away in 2022. The expectation is that a future legislature will resolve the Cook Inlet tax situation sometime between now and then. The way the bill has evolved, and there's been many different variations of the Cook Inlet ramp down, but the Rules Committee version keeps the 25% operating loss credit, but very tightly constrains it to say you must be in production by January of 2017. You must have production in calendar year 2016 or earlier, otherwise you're no longer eligible to get NOLs. the intent is to more or less cut the credit off to existing players and prevent newcomers to come in and be able to earn that credit. Meanwhile, the capital expenditure credit is repealed in 2017, similar to the governor's original bill. The well lease expenditure credit is reduced. It's sort of a slower ramp down to get to where the governor was. It's fully repealed in 2019. Now, this bill and other versions of the bill, including the other versions that passed House committees, it was removed in Senate resources, introduced the idea of a working group, a legislative group designed to look at a future tax regime for Cook Inlet. That is in the Rules Committee bill, and there's a little bit more explicit language saying the intent of that plan, the intent of that working group, should be to design a tax that takes effect in 2019. So although the tax caps are not being affirmatively sunset, they're implied that they're going to be replaced in January of 2019 when the new tax system takes effect. That new tax system does not exist yet. Okay, so that's the Cook Inlet fix. The North Slope fix, which ties forward to some statewide issues like the repurchase limitations and the so-called carry-forwards that the commissioner alluded to. The 35% operating loss credit is the number in place right now. That is pegged to the base tax rate of SB 21. The governor's original bill kept that in place. I want to note that that's not currently the administration's policy. This bill was written in the fall before we saw the spring forecast and we saw the potential extent of major producer operating losses, and we're now the position is now that we need to reduce or even eliminate the ability to carry forward operating losses, but that was the original proposal. We also put the cap or the limit on per company per year repurchases at $25 million per year. The original bill said that if you're a large company with more than $10 billion in annual revenue, you were not qualified to get cash, that if you had operating loss credits, you had to carry them forward to a future year when you had production and could use them against your own taxes. And then there was a 10-year sunset on the ability to use operating loss credits. So those were kind of the three-part change to the NOL carry-forward in the governor's bill. The Rules CS takes an interesting path that hadn't been seen before. First off, we keep the 35% NOL for 3 years, but only for what we're calling small producers, companies that produce less than 15,000 barrels a day or don't have any production at all, that are in the development stage. So the companies that are... Let me back up and say, Madam Chair, the loss has traditionally been used by companies who don't have any revenue. It's not so much that they're producing and losing money, but they are not producing yet. They're developing their first field, and their spending effectively is a loss. So the NOL is being transformed into that truly. It's only the companies that don't really have any revenue or have a very small amount of production, they can qualify for a loss. Those credits for those three transition years are capped at $75 million per company per year, higher than what's in the governor's bill, but lower than some other committee substitutes. This has been as high as $200 million in the House Resources Committee's version of the bill. However, beginning in 2020 for all companies, and in 2017 for the companies greater than 15,000 barrels a day, there is no more NOL credit. Instead, they're going to a regime that's more reminiscent of some other production sharing types, arrangements around the world, where all of your lease expenditures are kept as lease expenditures and they carry forward into a future year so that when that company has more revenue, either because they start producing or simply because the price of oil goes up, they can count current year lease expenditures against future year revenue. So in essence, it keeps the 35% value of the carry of the credit, only they're not calling it credit anymore. It's simply a carried forward lease expenditure to be used against future year revenue. What that does, and like I said, it keeps the 35% tax value, although indirectly. It does create a little bit of a difference between how that impacts the incumbent producer versus a new developer who might be several years away from production. It's a concern we've raised in previous testimony, and many of the producers who spoke in the Rules Committee brought up the same issue. If a major producer has a carried forward lease expenditure, it's effectively the same as an NOL. Once the price of oil goes up, whether it's 1 year or 5 years from now, they get to get that benefit immediately against their revenue that they'll be getting when the price goes up. But if you're a developer of a new field, you might be 5 or 8 years away from getting any material amounts of revenue, so you would have to hold those lease expenditures for those 5 years. By providing zero credit support, we are taking away that playing field leveler that we currently have through the NOL credit. And that's a concern that, that has been raised. I just want to flag that for the committee's attention.
Senator Machicki.
I use different terminology. When you say you're taking away the level playing field, aren't you actually creating a level playing field? The credits prior to a change had a somewhat of an advantage to smaller companies. Now it's placing everyone on a level playing field. Wouldn't you agree with that, Mr. Alper?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, somewhere in the middle. In the past, when the prices were high, I would say that it truly was a level playing field to have cash credits because the major producers were offsetting their expenses and paying less taxes by spending money. The independents were getting cash for their expenditures, and it was about level. When the prices dropped, we did, in fact, have a playing field tipped in favor of the independents because they were getting cash for their credits where the majors had to carry their losses forward. They weren't eligible to get cash for their credits. And then this is a rebalancer in the sense that for as long as prices remain low, both independents and majors will both be not getting any cash from the state. But once prices go up, there is something of an advantage to the producers because they have revenue against which they could offset their spending.
I have a follow-up, Senator Machicki.
Two questions, Director Alper. The 35%,
Thank you, Senator Kelly.
Holy cow. The 35% that is eliminated in 10 years, is that... So if you're a company and you have credits or expenses to go against to take off your taxes, and the 10 years is up, do you now have to write those losses off, or do you continue to carry those through and get repaid for those?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, I just want to clarify.
Are we talking
about the governor's original proposal with the 10-year?
Yes.
Okay, then I'll answer the question. Senator Kelly, through the chair, the idea was, yes, it's a little bit of a first-in, first-out situation. So if there's a limit on how much the state's repurchasing in a single year, we're going to be working through year one's credits until they're done, and then year two's and years. If we get to where we're 10 years behind, the company would be then losing those credits, and they would be falling off the table. That was the intent.
And you removed that? That's no longer in the...
The previous committees removed that. There is no sunset on the credits. Right. It's an unlimited carry forward in the Rules Committee bill.
And the governor's, I think you had said it's not in the current administration policy. Is it your preference to have that back in, or have you left that provision behind?
And I think Commissioner Hoffbeck will step in, but in general, the administration's policy is to not have operating losses for the major producers carry forward and simply be used in a single year to reduce taxes to zero and then be foregone if they would go below zero.
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, that is correct. That's the current.
Could you restate that?
That credits could be used in an individual year to take your tax to zero, but
right.
Any excess credits over above that would just simply be lost and couldn't be carried forward. Is the governor's
as
position.
Of 10 years?
As of the there's no carry forward at all.
At all. Okay, I see. All right.
Thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. Thank you, Co-Chairman Kelly, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Alper, to finish that question. You talked about things that are somewhat beyond our control on your definition of a level playing field. You talked about price, and you talked about whether or not a company is producing. Again, my terminology is a bit different. And the reason that concerns me is the hundreds of millions of dollars that we spent on some companies that did not end up producing and in some cases left the state. And that's a fairly significant exposure to the state. So, again, I'm not sure that we are thinking about a situation that creates an inequity on a playing field. We think our current system has a tendency to do that more so. I mean, it's kind of more of that big company bad, little company good thing. which is a part of our policy that we've dealt with for many years. And I just, we can say things creatively. I know you don't mean to do that, but the reality of it is our current system is not a level playing field. And just by the size of production that we have in there is somewhat challenging. Would you disagree with that?
I'll do my best through the chair. Senator Machicki, it is absolutely reasonable to say that the policy of the state for the last dozen years has been to actively encourage new players to come in, especially to the North Slope, and diversify the field. The tax credit system, especially the fairly open-ended refundable credit, was targeted at that. It was designed to make to give similar advantages to companies without revenue that the companies who have revenue get. There probably were companies who abused that, and there certainly are losses the state is having to eat for money that we spent without any filters, without any pre-approval processes, without any cash controls that we'll never be able to recover. To a certain extent, this bill is designed to ramp back some of those systems. The danger is, we have made a substantial investment in trying to bring newcomers and find new discoveries, and that the fine line we're trying to walk is to not pull the rug completely out from those companies who are two-thirds of the way along at our encouragement and our, to a certain extent, subsidy, and as we make these changes to leave them hanging.
Senator Kelly.
Most of what we're eating, what we ate, which you described as the state had to eat those expenses and they were unfiltered. Most of those came through ACES, correct? Through the ACES credits, the PPT credits, the exploration credits, those kinds of things. But not under the current regime, under the current tax regime, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, there's definitely a mix, and it has to do with time as much as anything else. Right. ACES was in place for 6 or 7 years, and there was a lot of spending. And at the time, the operating loss credit was 25 and the capital credit was 20, so we were paying for the most part 45% of companies' expenditures on the North Slope for ongoing development work if they didn't have any revenue up through 2013. Beginning with Senate Bill 21, the NOL credit was given its 2-year temporary bump up to 45%. That was designed in part as a hold harmless for those companies, so we would maintain the same level of support for the first 2 years, so that companies didn't feel that a benefit was taken away as the legislature implemented 21, so that 45% NOL was in place for through the end of 15, and only now have we reduced our level of support January of this year. All of the credits that are in our queue to pay now are based on that 45% NOL because they're 2015 spending. There's a couple of unique circumstances because of the gross value reduction and the new oil benefit of SB 21. I discussed this previously, and it's not really changed in different versions of the bill, but people are able to use the gross value reduction to synthetically inflate the size of an operating loss credit and create some very, very large state benefits, much greater than 45%. That's an unintended impact of Senate Bill 21. It's not huge dollars, but it's quite huge for a couple of companies, and we're trying to ramp that back with this bill.
So mostly what you described to me were credits that came from the previous tax regime, even if it was the 45%, where you had the 2 years that we allowed them to be held harmless. That's from ACES. So what you said about 21, which is the GVR credits, how big are those credits that you put in the mix there? That you said they're not substantial. What kind of money are we talking about from our point of view?
The technical calculation is if a company has a loss, an actual cash flow loss, typically their NOL should be a percentage of that loss. The law could be used that if you have the gross value reduction is a subtraction mechanism. Mm-hmm. You subtract from your revenue and pay taxes on a smaller number.
Well, I get that.
Subtraction making the loss larger, therefore leading to larger credits. At its peak in the $25 to $50 million a year range, okay. That's when the price of oil recovers a little bit.
Thanks. And as I was kind of rattling off all the different, I forgot to mention PPT and ELF. That was also part of it. So some of those credits that we've been dealing with that were unfiltered that you said we ate as a state, and you're absolutely correct, were go pretty far back, and far fewer of them are actually related to the tax regime that we're under currently.
And to be clear, through the chair, Senator Kelly, the net operating loss credit has been a consistent feature of our tax regime since PPT. Yeah. The numbers moved around the percentage, but the idea of reimbursing the companies who aren't making money for a percentage of their loss has been a consistent feature since we've had a net profits tax in all our different tax regimes.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, I'm moving to slide number 5, which talks about the minimum tax, or the so-called floor. This is a little bit different than credits, but it's a feature we addressed in our original bill, and it has been addressed to a greater and lesser extent directly and indirectly in different versions. The governor's original proposal was to increase the minimum tax, or floor, from 4% to 5% across all price points, and then we heard the term hardening it. Currently, the floor is harder in SB 21 than it was in ACES. The reason is in ACES, the 20% capital credit can be used to bring taxes down to zero. But with the elimination of that credit, the floor, the equivalent large credit on the North Slope was the per barrel credit. The per barrel credit was limited by the floor. What we discovered about a year ago as we started looking and modeling operating losses is if a company in year one has a loss, they could use their loss credit to go below the floor in year two. So we looked to harden that, and we also looked to say, let's not let other credits go below the minimum tax as well. The three specific instances, the $5 per barrel credit of new oil, GVR eligible oil, the small producer credit, and the exploration credit can all be used below the floor. We sought in our original legislation to harden the floor so that everyone had to pay the 4%, and in this case 5%, no matter what the circumstances.
Mr. Alper, can education credits be stacked to go before that floor? I don't think I heard you include that credit.
Madam Chairman, we did not include the exploration credit. The exploration credit could be used.
Education.
The education credit can be used against multiple taxes. And in our original version of the bill, we did not harden the floor to the education credit. There was one version, as it came out of the House Finance Committee, that did add the education credit to the floor hardening.
It's not in the rules.
And none of this hardening is in the Rules Committee. What the Rules Committee does, it does not change the nature of credits being usable against the floor. It does change the existence of credits. It eliminates the net operating loss credit. And in doing so, it indirectly hardens the floor because let's create an example of a major producer. Let's say a major producer loses $100 million. And under current law, they have a 35% or a $35 million NOL credit that next year, year two, they could reduce their floor payment. Once this NOL goes away, they don't have that $35 million credit anymore. Instead, they have $100 million in this year expenditures that they get to treat next year as if they were that year's expenditures and reduce their taxes, but they don't get to go below the floor. That floor, so it's an indirect hardening of the floor for the major legacy producers. And I'm going to probably need to say that a couple of different ways because I sense confusion in the room. So,
Commissioner would like to take a crack at it.
Yeah. Sure. Madam Chair, I think the easiest way to look at it is when it was a net operating loss, 35%, they could take the 4% and take it to zero. Now that they carry forward the expenditures and can write off 35% the marginal tax rate, they really don't get use of it until they're above the minimum tax. And so we're going to have to get $75 a barrel or higher before they'll actually be able to have any benefit from that because they're going to have something greater than a minimum tax to be able to take advantage of it. So it really is just where the credit gets applied. But it really doesn't change the dollars of the credit. But it is an advantage to the state to make that we would always have a 4% tax. What it does do is it defers that liability till sometime in the future when oil prices are higher.
Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Kelly.
I'm going to try to really simplify what everybody's saying. It partially eliminates double dipping.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I think you lost me at double dip. Yeah.
Mr. Alper.
Yeah. Help me understand the double dipping part.
Senator Bishop.
Because the way it is in the governor's version, you can't carry the 35% forward. You have to take it in that year. You could transfer the whole percentage into the following year, right, is what you said, and you can only get paid when we're back in the chips.
So, through the chair, Senator Bishop, the governor's original proposal allowed said you can't use your operating loss credits to go below the floor. You have to pay that floor, and then you have to roll them forward until we have real revenue, until we get to a higher price point. What the Rules Committee bill instead says is you get to deduct those expenditures in the future, but which means you can bring down your taxes all the way to the floor, but it's sort of a backdoor way of doing the same thing, because you're subtracting expenditures instead of preventing the subtraction of credits.
Senator Kelly.
Let me add less clarity. There's been so many versions, and it's been amazing. So, Commissioner, you said that under the, is it the 5% rule we're talking about here, the 5% floor? That
four or five doesn't make a difference for the discussion.
And you're saying at about $75 per barrel is where you wouldn't pierce, the floor wouldn't be pierced.
Right, and it would be a little bit higher at the 5%.
Okay. I was under the impression just from some conversations that number was much lower. That's clarity, and thank you.
Yeah, there is, through the Chair, Senator Kelly, a distinct crossover point. If you look at the graph of the state's revenue to the price of oil, there's an inflection, there's a bend in the curve, and that happens right around that $75. It was 80 last year, it's 75 this year, primarily because the company's spending is down, and that moves the rest of the numbers around as well.
Director Alper.
I can't let that one go by. Their spending is down. And I think that's been our biggest argument, Director Alper, is that their spending is down because they're losing money. And all of this is predicated on the fact that when they're losing money, they're going to spend less, and therefore their liabilities against the state are going to be less. And that's just a general overarching discussion, I think, that we disagree on, and that's okay.
Right. And certainly
thank
not,
you,
not
Senator
to
Kelly.
Debate.
Director Alper.
To clarify, The expenditure assumptions are down. Like we were forecasting $53 a barrel in spending 2 years ago. We're now at 46. That's already baked into the forecast. That's one thing I just needed to say.
Thank you.
Director Alper, is the current does current Alaska state statute have the floor at 4%?
Madam Chair, it's 4%. If the price of oil is above $25 a barrel, it's actually a step ladder down. It's 3% between 20 and 25, 2% between 1750 and 20, that sort of thing. But yes, and it's the floor, and then certain credits could be used to go below the floor. And then the change made by Senate Bill 21 was to say that the per taxable barrel credit, the sliding scale, can't be used to go below the floor. So that's the specific hardening that took place with the passage of SB 21.
And Director Alper, then with the statements that we heard at the start of this meeting that the governor was not going to touch SB 21, is this increasing taxes? Commissioner Hoffman.
Madam Chair, the 4 to 5% would be an increase in taxes, and that was one of the areas where it did touch SB 21, but it was done kind of as part of the process of everybody's tax was going to be increased. It wasn't meant to be a direct assault on SB 21, but just the fact that all of these various business operations within the state of Alaska were all going to see a little bit of an increase in their tax burden. So, and the governor actually did stay away from a couple of things that are now in the some of these other bills that we actually agree with, but we didn't put it in ours because we thought it did get too far into SB 21. One was the maturing of new oil, so that at some point in time it would no longer get the new oil provisions. We definitely discussed that. We thought it was an important component, but we thought that was getting too far into 21, so we didn't include that in our bill. And there's a couple of others in here like that. And some we tried to stay away from 21 as much as we could and just focus on the incentive credits, but we did cross over in a couple of places.
Co-Chairman Kelly.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, do you know how much what the dollar amount is for the 5 or the 4% if that's a hard floor? do you know what the total dollar amount to the state is going to be?
And our initial estimate, there was about $50 million was the difference between 4 and 5. I'm not sure if that's currently the estimate with the new forecast.
Through the chair, yes, about $50 million for the increase to the floor. And it moves a little with the price of oil. At $70 oil, it's going to be more like around $75 million. At $40 oil, a little less than 50. Now, but yes, that 1% order of magnitude is about $50 million. The other portion of the revenue from the so-called hardening the floor, or preventing credits from going below it, that changed dramatically between the fall and the spring. We initially saw that as about a $50 million revenue item. It moved to more like about $150 million revenue item, simply because the amount of operating losses earned by the major producers increased dramatically between the fall and the spring. And those were the ones that we were hardening it against. So we effectively scooped back more revenue through our original bill simply by lowering the price of oil.
So if I could.
Chairman Kelly.
Commissioner and Director, so the delta between a 4 and a 5 is about 50, possibly $75 million that goes up. And the total amount of revenue, if you take away, if you make the floor hardened at some level, 4%, is going to be about 150. That'll change over time, too,
right.
Of course.
But it's through the chair, Senator Kelly, there's about 160 million taxable barrels produced from the North Slope every year.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Good order of magnitude number to work with. So if the price of oil is $50 and the transportation is 10, that's about $40 worth of wellhead value. That 40 times the 160, that's $6.4 billion wellhead value of the oil. So 4% of that is about $250 million,
okay.
Round number. So that's the universe of the floor. To the extent we're losing some of it and hardening some of it back, that's the cap.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, just a general question. Obviously, the idea behind SB 21 was to stem the decline of production, because the more barrels you have, the more income theoretically, the more income you have for the state. And I have to believe that the administration shares that philosophy, correct? That we want more production on the slope for that very reason?
Absolutely.
So do you have any concerns at all that any changes on the slope, and we talked earlier about Cook Inlet being a whole different ballgame, but on the slope, do you see any changes? Are you concerned about any changes to the current way the slope is dealt with in terms of credits and tax, et cetera, royalty? Do you see that as potentially impacting that goal of producing more oil, or do you not? Because I think that's the crux of, I'm not going to speak for the entire group here, but for the most part, we want more production, so we have more revenue. How does what is being proposed in these different variations impact that from your perspective, or does it not?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, certainly any money that we take off the table is going to have some impact. The question is the impact in relative proportion to the amount of money that we're taking off the table. We were simply in a position where the level of credit support that we were offering, we could no longer offer. And so we wanted to try and put in place something that would be more robust, more sustainable, something that people could count on into the future, which had to be at a level where the state treasury could afford to make those credit payments. And so, sure, we're concerned. I think our bigger concern is, as Director Elper said, is that some of these projects that are in process, some further along than others, that have relied on the credit support to get as far as they have and need additional support to make it to the finish line, that you know, we want to make sure that we can get those projects completed. What we're trying to avoid is expenditures on credits on some areas where, quite frankly, the projects were pretty speculative, or would not be coming, would not benefit the state for many, many years, and that it was not a wise use of our limited resources at this point in time. And so, absolutely, I mean, pulling back on the credits is going to have some impact, but there was a necessary step we had to take because, quite simply, we just didn't have the cash to support the credits that were currently out there. And we were concerned that some of these projects were becoming credit-dependent, that the economics of the project was dependent upon the credits being available. And those, quite frankly, when you run the economics on them, don't ever pay back the state.
Senator Dunleavy, followed by Co-Chairman Kelly, followed by Senator Olson.
So, again, we know that getting a new field online, a new well producing, is a long-term process. It's from the moment you explore to develop, we could be looking for 10 to 15 years out. And so we need that, would you agree that we need that rolling exploration and production to keep, at a minimum, the current level of oil we're producing to keep the pipeline functioning, et cetera, and any interruption now, have you calculated or at least projected what the reverberations could be 10, 15 years down the line? I mean, if there's a pullback, which there is, activity-wise, because of the worldwide drop in prices and the balance sheets of some of these companies, as well as our balance sheet, how's that going to impact us 10, 15, 20 years from now? Do we have to be prepared that we could be potentially contributing to the end of the significant oil era? I mean, I think we all agree that we may not see a million barrels of oil again from those fields, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that's some of the concerns that we're wrestling with as we go through this process. Short-term dip, we make changes that may have long-term consequences for the state. And you folks are also weighing this, is what you're saying?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we had active discussions with developers and producers as we were developing our proposed bill, as did the Senate committee, that working group, to try and come up with something that took into account as many of the issues that these developers and producers had that we could accommodate in any package that we would move forward with. The bigger driver on how successful these fields are going to be and how much is going to be produced in the long term isn't the state tax credit program. It's the price of oil. I mean, the price of oil is what's going to drive the majority of the decisions that are made as far as developing fields. And at $40, $45 oil, there's not much of anything that's going to get sanctioned. It's going to take a price recovery in order to bring those fields online. And frankly, I don't know that there's enough money in the Treasury at $40 or $45 oil for the state to force these fields online with a credit program. So there's a balance point there. But I think everybody just has to take a deep breath right now and realize no matter what we do, they're going to lay down rigs and they're going to slow down development until oil prices recover.
Co-Chairman Kelly?
Commissioner, you had said that some of these investments never would pay off, that under the economics that we've attracted people that under the current economics. No, I think you said that we've attracted people that
the economics are now relying on the credits.
Yeah, and you said that they'll never pay off. My question is that how do we define payoff? Because as I was critical in the beginning of our discussion here, that we never seem to include royalties or tariff or heat going through the line or property tax to the different communities or income tax. So you're saying that we've attracted people that the projects will actually cost the state money. Actually, we will have a net loss. Or do you mean we will not have compared against maybe a production tax or something like that, that it wouldn't pan out?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, we've looked at them in both fashions, looking at them with just the production tax and then looking at all unrestricted revenues. And we could even add the restricted revenue in as well and to run the scenarios. And some of them, the credit support versus the size of the field and what will be developed, that the net present value to the state is negative.
Okay.
From the, and you know, There's a kind of a tipping point on the size of the field.
Sure.
That makes that difference. So.
Senator Olson. Director Alper.
Director Ken Alper. To Senator Kelly's question, as we get deeper into, say, NPRA, we don't get all the royalty all the time anymore either. The Greater Moose Tooth One, these sorts of things. This is a federal royalty on federal leases. We currently are going to be getting 50% of that. The near offshore, only 27%. So that if it's on private land, much of CD5 is on private land owned by ASRC. We actually don't get any of the royalty. We get a 5% of their royalty as a tax. A lot of the land that, say, Doyon is exploring in the interior is on their own land. So that, and there currently is no filter inside our credit programs, and it is a legitimate concern and something we have not yet found the language to address. But I think it's important to say that if we are going to be, to the extent we're providing large levels of state support, we should be sure that we do get money on the back end.
Senator Kelly.
Is this widespread or is this somewhat restricted?
The Chair, Senator Kelly, I would say it's small but growing and will likely grow because the future of the oil seems to be to the east and the west of where it's been.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Olson, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hear what you're saying about the price of oil is going to be dependent. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of effect on what goes on here. What we do have effect on is what we can do to encourage production, and that's kind of what we're dependent on. As you look at things from a more global perspective, dealing with credits, whether they're expiration of production and NOLs and the floor and things like that, has there been success by other sovereigns that have or other states that have got the same situation? Have they been successful in the end having a greater production by manipulating their tax? Because I guess the biggest fear I have is the more we manipulate it, the more unstable we appear. And our consultants have said that you know, every 10 years we're having five or six changes, significant changes. I guess has this, when you look at it from a public policy standpoint, has there been successes where they've been manipulating like the tax scheme like we have?
Through the chair, Representative Olson. I expect Analytic has probably done more work on that than I have. I mean, at these low oil prices, nobody's being successful. I mean, they're laying down rigs all over the world. In fact, I think it was Bloomberg that put out an article yesterday or the day before that talked about because people companies have been able to pull back on their costs, that at about a $50 price point that you may see some rigs come online again. And that, but you're going to need sustained $50 oil or higher before you actually see people start investing in new projects. And so, to the extent that you can work on the margins of that, I suppose you could bring some fields online, but you couldn't force a $40 price point to start bringing that online. But if you're teetering on the 50, could you offer some incentives that might bring the dollars here versus elsewhere? Sure.
So you're optimistic.
The chair representative also, the prices will recover. I think it's going to be a slower recovery than we've seen in the past, and I don't think the top end is where we've seen in the past, but I don't think the oil industry is dead yet.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy, did I see your hand up?
Yes, through the chair, I'm pondering something here. So the cost to do business on the slope is probably greater than the cost to do business in the lower 48. Would you agree in the oil industry in terms of exploration and drilling?
Chair, I agree.
So if they pull back on investment, which you're saying they are because of low oil prices, does tax policy matter in trying to retain some of that investment potentially for the future on the slope? Or do we end up with a situation where a combination of this dip in prices has them pull back on investment, and then any change in this policy has them rethink their investment to where they'll put their dollar where they're going to get a better return, which may be in the lower 48?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think stable tax policy is important. But there was no stability in the tax policy we had right now because the Treasury could not support it, so that a change had to be made, and so the I don't think, you know, this wasn't something we entered into because we came, the administration came and said we wanted to fix this particular issue. It was one that was laid in our lap because we simply, the amount of money coming in available for expenditures was not commensurate with the outlay. And quite frankly, it's because the credits aren't price sensitive, not directly price sensitive. They do have some, as Senator Kelly said, they're going to slow activity at lower prices, but that is not a direct correlation to the price of oil versus the amount of credits. And oil prices dropped dramatically. We've had some charts we've shown before. The amount of revenue the state dropped precipitously, and the credits went up, and the credit liability. And that we had a regime that was not sustainable. And until we have a sustainable regime, we can't offer that long term stability. So.
Co-Chairman Kelly, followed by Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Machicki.
Commissioner, words matter, and I think you said the Treasury couldn't sustain the current tax policy. I think there's a lot of disagreement in this building about that, and that's why we're here. And I think if you peel Cook Inlet away from the North Slope, that disagreement would even get greater. If we're just talking about Cook Inlet, that's one thing, because 60% of the credit problem that we're having right now, I think, comes from the north, from Cook Inlet. But I just don't buy it that the Treasurer can't support it. And one of your slides, and believe me, I know that these numbers aren't the current numbers because the environment has changed so much. But your slides from a few weeks ago, you know, we had invested $7.4 billion in credits. And we got $61 billion back in revenue. Now, if somebody decides somewhere that $7.4 billion was too high, well, that's debatable. But the fact is that most people would buy into any kind of investment like that. We don't have the luxury of that, this kind of investment now. I understand it, but the principles are the same. Credits have attracted companies to the North Slope that we wanted to attract to the North Slope. Most of the problems that we have are self-correcting because they're going to spend less over time. And one of my fears that I won't go off on that, but I just want to say when you say the Treasury won't support it, that's a big concept to Mr. and Mrs. Alaska sitting out there. Oh my gosh, we'll run out of money if we keep paying these credits under the current tax regime. That's not a true statement.
Commissioner
Hoffbeck,
briefly.
Just through the chair, just to go back at those numbers, the majority of that large amount of revenue that was generated was at a point in time where we had very little or no credits exposure. The credit exposure has grown over the last few years when our revenue has been very low. So there, we have to be careful in making that correlation, too, that the credits created that type of a.
We had $7.4 billion worth of credits under your model. That's correct. A big number.
Correct.
Yeah.
But the majority of the $64 billion or whatever actually was generated prior to the that was under past tax regimes and.
I know. That's okay, why I say that was from 2007 to 2015. I know. Right. I'm just saying the principle remains. Fine. Credits, you could, from your model, credits stacked up against revenue was a pretty good investment. It's less of a good investment now. No question about that.
Okay, fair enough.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go off on a philosophical discussion, but I'm not. I'm just going to keep it real tight because I want to, and I'm making this point to the Commissioner, because you said something there, and I've been pondering this for a month trying to get a little traction with an idea. And you said credits, and if I'm misquoting you, you correct me, but you said credits are not price sensitive.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that is correct.
Okay. So let's just all, I just want to say that on the record because I'm going to come back to that to a point in time. So thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Here I go getting another thumbs down again, but this is an appropriate discussion to be having right now. And the fact is that production for the sake of production has very little value on our bottom line. Net negative production across a broad spectrum of pricing is the problem we're talking about. We're not talking about, I mean, we talk about the value to the state over the long term. The park and Prudhoe Bay were developed essentially void of all credits. It was based on what works in an oil field, and that's price and geology, right? And you made a statement a minute ago exploration, development, and production on the slope being more expensive. That goes on a field-by-field basis. When you look at the sort of non-conventional production in the lower 48, there are instances on a field-by-field basis that are far more expensive than some of our production on the slope. The only point I'm saying is it's appropriate to be having the discussion. I think we have some exposures that are healthy to talk about. We want the most robust policy going forward, but we also want to be using accurate numbers, and we want to understand exposure to the state. And I'm okay with having that conversation. I don't think it's a negative thing. We have some pieces of our tax policy, particularly as we move west, that I think there are some things that we need to look at, and I think that's perfectly appropriate. But I do want to be operating with accurate numbers. When we started this meeting, we talked about the spring forecast, and I'd love to see an update. I mean, for FY17, we forecasted 2803. Obviously, that's going to be somewhat different. That means the property, the only thing it may not change is the property tax, but corporate income tax is going to change. Oil and production and gas production taxes are going to change. I mean, the revenue outlook is going to be different. The royalty is going to be different. Have you actually run new numbers on your new assumptions, including $150 million of additional revenue, the drop of credit, which you assumed to be sort of on the trend prior to FY17 that we were seeing earlier? I mean, things are going to change. We're going to have more revenue, from what I can tell, on production taxes alone than what we're paying out on credits, especially if you make that adjustment from the 775 to the 580 that we're actually be paying out in additional credits. And I'm more than happy to have that discussion. I think there are adjustments that need to be made, but is that something the Department of Revenue can provide for us to understand sort of our true exposures for not only at the end of FY16, but FY17 and going forward as well?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that I didn't quite follow all of the numbers, but at the beginning of our presentation, Senator Hoffbeck referenced that roughly $25-30 million per dollar in the price of oil swing. You know, we're for FY16, we're probably going to come in $2-3 above the forecast is what we're saying now. FY17, the forecasted number is $39 a barrel. We have a report that we would like to we could send to the committee that shows GFERG, General Fund Unrestricted Revenue, for the next 10 years as a function of the price of oil, and then where our forecast is, so where the elasticity, to use an economic term, is. That I think that's a really useful baseline document that we've provided to a lot of committees every time we update it, most recently updated for the spring. I carry around with me a stack of fiscal notes. There are, I think, 8 different tables now for the different versions of the bill before you. Each of those fiscal notes has 2 subtotals. One of them is revenue, to a certain extent, not just through the minimum tax, but through moving a lot of other little pieces. We change the revenue to the state. It moves up, it moves down. You know, typically, these bills are raising another $25 to $100 million, as well as what it saves. The savings is, that's the part that people are talking about more because they know about this 775, 575, 500, whatever the number is. The intent is to reduce it. So to what extent is this bill going to reduce the forecast versus another version of the bill? And then the other half of it is, to what extent is this bill going to change our revenue? And we've tried to – it's hard with so many versions of the bill to keep it all straight, but we've tried very hard to have this stack of fiscal notes. And it actually might be useful, and we'll provide for the committee a fresh set of all of those tables for the 7 or 8 bills that have been in play, so we could look at them – apples to apples and side by side.
Just a quick.
Senator Machicki.
My goal is, I'm not planning a flag in the ground about what I'm willing to do, because I am willing to compromise. What I think is most important, and you guys read the press, right? What's more important to me is removing the rhetorical nonsense from the discussion and talking about real numbers so that we can make good decisions. And I think you're both in the position to help us with that, help Alaskans understand what some exposures we should be looking at. We may not agree on all the aspects of it, but certainly on price, value, and sort of a forward-looking process that results in healthy production, net positive production in the future. We're all going to be hit kind of hard when things are in the low 30s, but we think we'll have some improvement. I just want to have an honest discussion with Alaskans, separate the rhetoric and make good decisions using those facts. And I think you can both be very helpful with that.
Director Alper.
Yeah, let me thank you, Senator Michicki. I think it is important that we all have honest facts and figures, and I want to say something that I think is important for the legislature and, frankly, the public at home to recognize. Very little that we can do with this legislation is going to affect FY17's demand. That 775 is baked in. It's money that's already been spent by companies and obligations that the state has already incurred. Unless we're going to have retroactive effective dates that change the nature of how we're repurchasing credits that already exist, we're not really going to change that. What we're working on are the credit exposures for FY18 and beyond with this legislation. So to a very small degree, is any part of this going to impact next year's budget?
Mr. Director Alper, I've been waiting. The administration has compounded the problem through the veto. We have $200 million that Alaskans are shouting about that should have been taken care of in a previous year. So the conversation has become very convoluted when we start throwing out $775 million, when the number should be closer to $500 to $600 million as a starting point. So it's a bit frustrating that we're trying to unring a bell that we knew we had an obligation for, and that the legislature stepped up and to some degree met the obligation knowing that it was outstanding. And so not only has the veto created problems inside of the working environment for the companies, but quite frankly, I had a discussion with the OMB director on every point that negative point that has happened for the state of Alaska, for the industry, for the layoffs. And so now we're compounding it further by using that veto that was done for the right reasons from the administration's perspective. I'm not trying to bang the governor. The governor thought he was doing the right thing. I can only take the high ground and think he thought he was doing the right thing. But the legislature tried to discuss with the administration the ramifications, and now today we've got different math before us because of that one point in time. And now it's exasperating the conversation. And it's actually compounding the frustration in trying to solve the problem, because we're poking at the numbers and we know that they're not all exactly how they should be. And I've heard it expressed multiple times at this table that a variety of media outlets pick up these stories differently and shape the conversation how they believe they should shape the conversation. And it's just it's frustrating from a chairman's position as we try to work through this, when you can't unring the bell. The $200 million veto happened. We did not go back in as a legislative body and override that, but we're sort of carrying forward this baggage from administrative decisions as well as past legislative decisions on the tax structure itself, from the credits that are decades ago. And we're creating, again, instability inside of industry, and I'm just having a really difficult time finding a direction forward that actually, as multiple members of this team have talked about, is should we shoot ourselves in the foot right now? Because every dollar that we deploy somewhere else for a one-time expense versus investing in long-term production, is going to impact Alaskans differently in the future. And I totally agree with Senator Machicki's comments that we should not produce, we should not have production if it's a negative impact to the state of Alaska. And so that's what Alaskans, that's what the media, that's what the governor has been shouting about in those form of credits. And the legislature, I believe, is willing to take on those corrective reforms where we should not be investing. But we had an announcement back to the NOLs in the slide before us in talking about net operating loss carry forward. BP, I believe, was the one who indicated publicly that we would see a drop in production of 50,000 barrels based 40,000 barrels. And I assume that's going forward in FY17, so help me there. I don't want to assume, but that statement was for a 40,000 barrel decrease. Is it in FY17? That's the first question. And then with the laydown of rigs, Director Alper, I know that we have talked about that the spring forecast does reflect some of the laydowns. Can you tell us the amount of net operating losses change that is reflected in knowing those rigs are going down and that production is going to be less? I guess another way to say it is how overstated could the NOLs be at $45 a barrel?
So, certainly, Madam Chair. So, yes, the BP laydown is internalized in our forecast of both spending and production. I think that 40,000 barrel, and Ms. Weiss was quoted in that article, said she doesn't think it's going to be that bad. That's a little bit of a worst-case scenario. And I think it's a couple of years of cumulative impact of the loss. It's not an immediate drop. We're talking about the initial producing area in Prudhoe Bay, which the base production is around 250,000 barrels a day. So we're going to more or less be speeding up the decline curve for that oil is what we're talking about. A good easy number to work with is so our forecast number for the end of FY16 that the carried forward NOLs from the majors is $357 million. That's a number that's in the forecast. Every dollar shift in the price of oil moves that number by about $65 million. So if we're $5 above what we say, 5 times 65 is about $325. That basically wipes that out. You know, in other words, at that $46 break-even price for oil, the NOLs are zero. At $39, it's $350 million. And somewhere in between, the number ramps down.
Director Alper, and with that statement, zero to $350 million, we've ridden this roller coaster before, or we've been to this rodeo before, and it's not a pleasant time, absolutely. But should you change major policy that supports long-term investment and revenue to the people of Alaska, when the governor's proposed a variety of taxing alternatives to try to stabilize this particular moment in time, they're not moving forward. I haven't seen a great amount of love for all of the other industries that we were going to touch. And I know this has been labeled the log jam, the oil and gas tax credit conversation for getting out of Juneau. I believe I heard someone talk about that yesterday in the media.
Madam Chair, we share your frustration at the lack of movement of the rest of the governor's fiscal package. There is one of the bills that's in your committee right now, that the motor fuel tax bill. There are three of them in the House Finance Committee. The others have all been heard. This is something of the logjam. I don't know how much time there is left on the clock to move the rest of it. Those are smaller numbers, of course, even if all of our, setting aside the income tax for a moment, the other six smaller revenue bills add up to only about $150 million a year. They are material to the people who pay them, but they're not, in the aggregate, going to balance our budget. What's going to balance our budget is bigger things, of which this is one of the bigger things. I share your frustration. The NOLs could be gigantic. They could be non-existent. The commissioner, I think, said it very well. We need to protect ourselves against the fact that it might be gigantic, meaning it's okay to get no money if the price of oil is low. That makes intuitive sense. That's why we have our savings. But when the price of oil recovers, we want to make sure that we do get revenue. And the fear is that all of these carry forwards might eat tomorrow's revenue even after the price of oil goes up, and that's the danger we're trying to address in part here.
Director Alpert, the reason I am hovering on this particular point is because you're asking us, at least from some's perspective, based on a price per barrel of oil at 44 this week, to remove credits that have provided, as Co-Chairman Kelly said, from the 2007 to the 2015 time period, $61 billion. And I know those were from past. If I didn't state it right, please state it correctly. Well,
Madam Chairman, the great bulk of the oil production that's paid our taxes is wells that were drilled long ago. That oil was going to come, frankly, no matter what prior legislatures did. And we did experience a tremendous windfall at unanticipated high prices. The ACES system, to the extent that SB 21 didn't adequately contemplate low oil prices, I believe ACES didn't adequately contemplate high oil prices. That we had a tremendous, when we got $9 billion in production tax revenue, almost $7 billion in production tax revenue in a single year, and over $9 billion in total oil and gas revenue, that was well outside anybody's forecast. That sort of took us by surprise. We've been fortunate that it happened simply because it gave us the savings to outlast this period and not be in a utter panic right now. We do have money to get through this, at least for the moment, largely because of those windfalls that came in prior years. I had one slide that said we spent $38 in credits for every dollar of new oil. That's probably a little unfair on the high side. To put $60 billion to our $7 billion in credits is a little unfair to the low side. The real answer is probably somewhere in the middle.
Co-Chairman Kelly.
You said something that kind of disturbed me. You said if prices are low, we don't expect to make money. But if they recover, we don't want the losses to eat up the money that we would get in the future when prices recover. I don't think that's the place the state wants to be. We want people producing even though the price is low. They are producing somewhat, and it's less and less, no question about that. We don't want to discourage them from producing at low prices, so that when prices recover, we're somehow covered. We want them putting holes in the ground so that when prices recover, there's a whole bunch of money. We'll get a little bit less at first, but we'll get more into the future. What we're doing, this is truly not eating our seed corn, but demanding that we eat everybody else's seed corn. Commissioner, you have something to say?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly. I think one of the things that the governor's plan focuses on is this idea that of this $35 to $60 price range reality that we're going to be in for a while, and really a lot of what we're doing here is recognizing that reality is a long-term reality, and that this $80, $90, or $100 oil may not be in our future, and so some of these adjustments need to be made because we see this price point as our future, and the credits not fitting within that price point. It's not necessarily being driven by this $40 oil price point. It really is the range of prices we see as our future.
Commissioner, do you see why I'm concerned with this, sort of the $200 million vetoed amount being carried forward and now being used as sort of the torpedo with Alaskans to say we're going to have to pay oil companies? Well, the only reason we might have to pay them, or it's not the only reason, but a reason, is because we didn't pay them when we were supposed to. And now we're hovering right on the marker of the NOL numbers that you're presenting us could evaporate, but you're wanting us to still pull the trigger on reducing a possible revenue shortfall in our future. And if we pull the trigger, we help reduce production.
Madam Chair, I think we recognize that. And we certainly, I think, in Director Alper's initial comments with House Rules yesterday, he very specifically parsed out that $200 million as being an anomaly, and that because of that, the 775 is a high watermark. We don't expect $775 million in credits any year going forward. So that we've tried to pull back from that as much as we can, but like you said, you can't necessarily get it back. But we are sensitive to the fact that we do want to fix, I think, what was an unforeseen issue in SB 21 of what happens at prolonged low oil prices, and I think there's some issues that just weren't modeled, and now we're living with them, and we're saying let's fix them so that if we roll back down into $35 oil again, that we've got the system in place that deals with those. The reality is if there aren't any net operating losses, it's not going to have an impact immediately on the producers because there wouldn't be anything for them to carry forward anyway. But at least everybody would know what happens next time it goes down.
Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just some comments. We're looking at 6 proposals here on a piece of paper, and those of us that have been around, since 1977, you look at all the iterations of oil tax policy, and I just got to say, I'm not dinging anybody, it's just comments. When's enough enough? I mean, when is enough going to be enough? And the reason I say that is it gets back to stability. And let's hypothetically say that we're going to come out of here with something on these six items here, come out with a policy, and who's going to guarantee me that in 19 months we're not going to be back here fixing some other little widget that is unforeseen, and we've all thought that we've done the best damn deal we can do here today. And my point is, and now I'm going to say it, is if we ain't got the guts to ride this little bit of thing out here right now, we got no business hooking up to a 30-year AKLNG project at 25% ownership in that deal, because we would be writing checks our body couldn't cash in the 3 cyclical up and down commodity prices in that environment. And now, because we're a 25% interest working partner with the other 3 producers. And I'm not saying that we couldn't be a subtle fix here, but we could do a subtle fix, and we're going to be back here 19 months from now doing another subtle fix. And I just look back in history. We just can't keep our hands off the engine, And so, anyway, that's just...
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, it's just getting confusing, this conversation, because Commissioner, you probably didn't realize this, but you just gave our local newspaper that their headline, we need to fix an anomaly in SB 21, is what you said. I just asked you earlier if we're dealing with SB 21, and you said no. And then we spoke earlier about the majority of these tax credits are Cook Inlet, which were PPT and variations before SB 21. And all I'm saying is, from my perspective, just when I think we're making headway, things are said that are kind of muddling the conversation. And quite honestly, Madam Chairman, we've sort of talked about this, but we almost need to break out Cook Inlet, deal with that as its own bill, and then we can then talk about the $207 million or $307 million that deal with the slope and those credits. Because in my, all these parts are floating around. Are we dealing with Cook Inlet tax credits? Are we dealing with Cook Inlet where we don't have a tax on oil production because Cook Inlet is mainly gas? Are we talking about SB 21, an anomaly in SB 21? Are we talking about tax credits on the slope? And so it gets all balled up. And I know that's not the intent,
But I'm going to strongly suggest, and I'll work with folks here, to break out Cook Inlet to deal with that issue, because we're talking over the subjects. We keep going back to oil production, oil price, oil this. I thought we all agreed that the majority of the tax issue was legacy tax issues with Cook Inlet.
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Senator Dunleavy, the issue of dealing with the carry forwards is something that's really kind of developed during the session based on the spring forecast. The governor's original plan did not deal with this issue at all. And so when I say that the governor legitimately did not try and change SB 21 except in the few pieces that we talked about it. But this is something that's developed through the committee process and through with the spring forecast and the issues associated with long-term low oil prices that has surfaced and the bill's in play and so it's become a part of the bill. It was not part of the original plan, but it is something the governor now sees as an issue to deal with. So.
I get that. Just to follow up, but just this quote, we need to fix an anomaly in SB 21. I'm just saying when Whittley squirted lighter fluid on this, which really should be a numbers issue for the state because of a political issue wrangling over this issue that we thought was dealt with a year or two ago. So, again, I'll talk with folks about possibly doing a separate approach on cooking.
Brief, please. Good morning. We're back on the record. This is Senate Finance. We're at the Bill Ray Center in Juneau, Alaska, room 230. It's 11:21. We have a full finance team. We are on slide five. Mr. Alper.
Madam Chair, continuing on with the presentation, slide, we're just about done with slide five, and I had such a great conversation about the NOL issue and how the floor is sort of hardened in the Rules Committee version. I hate to throw one more wrinkle in it, but the last bullet I never got to, and that is presuming those carry-forward NOLs that we were talking about a few minutes ago, before the effective date of the bill, they're still NOLs. After the effective date of the bill, they change to this new lease expenditure construct. So those carried-forward NOLs would be used against minimum tax payments until they're effectively used up. So when you look at the modeling of the Rules Committee bill, you don't see any revenue impact from the hard floor until about FY20, because those first couple years, the companies would be working through those NOLs that are in our forecast as occurring in the short term.
Director Alper, yeah. Is that intentional to provide companies an opportunity to finance, to acquire capital? Was it intentional? Do you know?
No, Madam Chair, the NOLs as a carry forward is simply current law, and just by the nature of it, by creating this new system with an effective date in 2017, it's how the system absorbs those things that would already be existing.
Thank you. Okay. Please continue.
So I'm going to move on to slide number six, which is
Co-Chairman Kelly. Oh.
Director Alper, could you just essentially repeat what you just said? It didn't stick for me.
Sure thing. So, Senator Kelly, in current law, the companies earn NOL credits and if they're major producers, they have to carry them forward and use them against future year taxes. Under current law, they're able to go below the floor with those credits. Starting on January 1st, 2017, in the Rules Committee substitute, that ends. There is no more NOL credit per se. What happens is the costs that generate that credit are what carries forward instead of a credit. Those costs can't go below the floor. Those costs simply go into the future tax calculation. However, before the effective date, there are all the NOLs that came in under the prior system, under the current system. It's going to take about 2 years for them to use those up below the floor before we actually see any floor impact in revenue.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Slide six.
Madam Chair, slide six. We're now talking about the new oil, the gross value reduction, GVR. Again, I hate the acronyms. The governor's bill did not propose changing the nature of the gross value reduction other than the technical interaction with the operating loss credit that I'll get to in a future slide. But as the bill evolved, starting in the House Finance Committee, we started seeing this idea of graduation, where the general concept that new oil shouldn't be new oil forever, that the various benefits that come with the new oil, the reduced taxation through the subtraction mechanism of the GVR, the different per barrel credit, and the ability to go through below the floor to zero, all of those features should sunset at some point, and the new oil should eventually become old oil. And then it becomes a math question or a policy question. What's the number? Different versions of the bill have said 5 years, 7 years. I've seen there was a floor amendment that went from 5 to 7. The bill before the committee, the Senate Resources Committee substitute, was 5 years. The bill that came out of the Rules Committee yesterday is a 10-year sunset. But conceptually, it's all the same. At some point, the new oil becomes old oil and begins to pay taxes and be treated for tax purposes the way the legacy oil is treated. So that is now what's in the Rules Committee version is a 10-year graduation provision. And that's all there is to slide six. Without questions, I'm going to move all the way to slide seven. Except I just turned it off. What did I? May I have a brief at ease to try to fix the projector?
Director Alper.
there's a little bit of a hodgepodge of some of the smaller provisions. Most of these have limited dollar value, but and they, for the most part, survived in different versions of it. I'll go through them fairly quickly. But the idea of the gross value reduction not being used to increase the size of an operating loss credit, that's been in every version of the bill. There's been some consensus that that is an unanticipated mathematical error within Senate Bill 21 that we're looking to clean up. I said in response to Senator Kelly's question about an hour ago, this will peak in value to the state at about a $25 to $50 million impact in essentially more revenue that we will get or fewer credits that will go out, depending. That is in this version of the bill. The municipal utility lease expenditure issue, you might recall when I went through the bill originally before this committee, the idea is a municipal utility that owns its own gas field and burns it mostly in their own turbines, that is a non-taxable activity. But if they have a little bit of surplus gas and they sell it to a third party, you can imagine, say, if Anchorage Muni has a little extra gas and sells it to NSTAR, say, that is a taxable sale. The treatment of that taxable sale is important, although not huge dollar value. And the way the law is currently written, they would be able to subtract 100% of their lease expenditures, even if they only sold 2 or 10% of their gas. There's a pro-ration fix that's in the bill that fixes that problem going forward. The transparency issue, this has had a lot of conversation, a lot of policy issue. It's not really a dollar value issue, but we have this data set of all the people that have got all these credits, and we can't tell you. It's confidential taxpayer information pretty universally. To what extent can we open that window a little bit going forward and say, we would like to report that this company gets X dollars in credits? So the way we proposed it was to say not just cashable credits, but all credits, and then what is the general purpose? What are the company using the state's contribution for? There's a somewhat of a watered-down version in the current bill, but there is some of the first transparency language that we've seen in a committee substitute to say that going forward the state can release the name of the company and the total dollar values and cashable credits that they've received. That is an important change. One caveat, one weakness to that in the current bill, in the rules bill, is that I'm going to pause for a moment till the siren goes by, if you don't mind.
Brief, please. We're back on the record. Director Alper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because the Rules Committee bill eliminates all the cashable credits in 3 years and converts everything to the operating loss paradigm, to the extent there's benefit from this transparency, it goes away in 3 years because the way it's written, we would not be reporting carried forward operating losses, just actual cash credits. But there is a transparency provision in the Rules Committee bill. Another provision is on the subject of interest rates. This is an interesting, a little bit esoteric topic. The interest rate on delinquent taxes, this is not just oil and gas, but all of the taxes administered by the tax division, was reduced in SB 21 from 11% compounding, which pretty much everyone agreed was too high, and it led, if there were enough years of delay, to the sometimes the interest almost outstripping the delinquency itself, to 3% and simple interest. We've made the case, and we believe convincingly, that the simple interest was an error, that there was a technical error in a late amendment to SB 21. So we've seen compound interest in every committee substitute. Then the question becomes, at what rate? And then because of issues of specifically in the production tax that my staff has been several years behind on some of these audits, should we be rewarded for that delay? Should there be a reduction in the interest rate after X number of years? And that's been in various versions. The version before you does not have any step down. It goes to a 5% over the Fed. The federal number is about 1% right now with low interest rates. So the state would be getting 6% on delinquent taxes. That's a number that we like going forward. It's close enough to what we see as the permanent funds rate of return on their investments, the CBR, if and when it starts being invested more aggressively, its rate of return. Because if we're not getting money in taxes and we're having to cover that out of savings, when we finally get paid back at the end of a tax audit process, the general administration position is we should get paid back at our opportunity cost. What did we forego for having to take that money out of savings to cover the loss and then pay it back two or three or hopefully not for much longer 6 years later. And 5% over Fed compounding, and we're very happy with that number in the Rules Committee bill. Moving on to slide 8, a few more of these technical provisions. Alaska Hire, a hot topic, an interesting topic, an important topic to the governor. The way it was originally put in the bill was to say we are going to limit the cash to the percentage of Alaska Hire. In plain terms, if you have, let's say, a $10 million credit coming to you and you have 70% Alaska Hire, well, we're only going to give you $7 million in cash. The other three would have to be rolled forward and used against taxes in the future. That was the way the bill was initially structured. That was not liked very much by the taxpayers who thought there was a lot of uncertainty in that. The way that the bill has evolved is to say, if there is a shortfall, if there is a limitation in the amount of money, which could certainly happen, if anything, we're seeing that for the first time because of the governor's line item veto that you spoke to earlier, Madam Chair. If there is limited money, what is the process by which we prioritize and rank order who gets the money and who has to wait another year? And what we're doing in the Rules Committee substitute is saying those companies that have the 80% Alaska Hire threshold are ranked in advance of those who don't. So in the presence of limited funds, then we're going to make sure that those who have more Alaska resident hire are going to be getting their money first. There's a lot of moving parts to that. There's the ability to say, do a straight-up rank order. The 82% company would come in better than the 78% company. There's the question of should this be extended to the contractors. Personally, and the administration believes that it should, because for the most part, the work is done by the contractors. That's really where we're going to see the Alaska Hire numbers, but that's not what's in the Rules Committee substitute. It's tied to the company themselves that's obtaining the credit and a straight-up above or below criteria on the 80% Alaska Hire. Moving past that, the next one, delinquent obligations to the state. Right now, under current law, the state, the tax division, could withhold a credit to pay a tax. If the company is late on another tax, a production tax, a property tax, a cigarette tax, it doesn't matter, we could withhold a tax credit to pay that tax on behalf of the company before we pay the credit. What we sought to do in the original version of House Bill 247 is extend that power to non-tax liabilities, the most obvious one being a royalty, but also fines and fees and workers' comp or anything else. That was maintained in various versions of the bill with some restriction, that restriction being the obligation would have to be relevant to the company's oil and gas business, and then we could withhold the money, but we can't actually pay the obligation unless the company consents to us doing so. So that's more or less the way the bill is structured coming out of the Rules Committee. And finally, this is the last substantive point in the presentation. Some sort of mechanism to protect unsecured creditors in event of a bankruptcy. This was a recommendation from the working group, the Senate working group from the interim, Senator Giesel's group. It was not a provision that we found a mechanism to deal with in the governor's original bill. There was a mechanism presented in the House Resources Committee that's evolved as the bill has moved on of a surety bond, similar to what contractors put in place with the state, a certain dollar value that we have in hand, and then should there be a need, a bankruptcy, that bond would be attachable by local vendors. They would be the first secured creditors. And right now it's written with a $250,000 number, and it's written that it would go away once the company came into production. Both of those are variables that could move as the bill continues to move on, but in general we support the idea of a surety bond for unsecured creditors. And that, Madam Chair, one more slide, I'm sorry. This is the side-by-side. This pulls in some of the greatest hits from the various fiscal notes. We're really just looking at 4 years of three different variants, the governor's original bill, the bill before this committee, the Senate Resource Committee substitute, and the Rules Committee bill. The total bill impact is an important number, and then, of course, the NOL carry-forward issue. The governor's bill was much more aggressive in its effective dates, and in the especially the effective date of the hardening of the floor. That's why you see some very large numbers in the early 1 or 2 years. All of the other versions have had a much more measured and delayed gradual implementation of many of the features. You see in the Rules Committee bill, however, $175 million impact by FY20. in part from the hardening of the floor and in part from the very dramatic ramp down of the Cook Inlet credit, and also the reduction, the per company caps on repurchasing of credits. And the last line of this table, and once again, to get the full flavor of this, it's important to look at the fiscal notes of the various bills in their entirety. But the one weakness of the governor's bill, which came out in the spring forecast, was the very large NOL carryforwards. Effectively, if you harden the floor without changing the nature of the NOL credit itself, what we're doing is borrowing money from the future. We're taking more revenue now and having to pay it back at some future point. And that's why you see these very large carry-forwards in the governor's bill. By a softer version of hardening the floor, the other versions of the bill did not have quite so much of a carried-forward obligation. But you still see in the Rules Committee bill at the end of FY20, $685 million. That number reflects production taxes we won't receive once the price of oil goes back up, because companies will be able to use them either through lease expenditures or through actual credits to offset future taxes.
Thank you, Director Alper. It's brief at ease. We're back on the records. Senator Machicki.
When we talked about borrowing from the future, I just think it's important. You talked about the $685 under the Senate rules, and of course the $508 million for remaining not operating loss carry forward exposure, but of course the governor's bill has essentially twice that in future exposure, $1.2
billion. Chair, that's absolutely true. In large part, that's paying back a lot of the additional revenue that comes in the governor's bill through the hardening of the floor.
Thank you, Director Alper. Thank you, Senator Machicki. With that, you do have a comparison that Director Alper provided us. We do have a floor session that begins shortly, so if there's not any other questions, I'd like to adjourn for the day. Anything else to come before the committee? Commissioner Hopback? Director Alper, thank you for joining us today in Senate Finance. We look forward to continuing this discussion. With that, we're adjourned.